while they were administering first aid, I was also there after the bulldozer drove over her and then backed up.
Now we see, I think, just a kind of fevered frenzy in the press to get on board.
I know that millions of people around the world share this sense of disappointment and are deeply alarmed by the prospect of imminent war.
The world braces for a U.S. invasion into Iraq while security levels in the U.S. reach code orange levels and a United Nations emergency session goes almost without notice. This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, March 19, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. American troops, armored vehicles, and trucks have begun advancing toward the Iraqi border, positioning themselves to invade with just hours remaining before President Bush's deadline for Saddam Hussein to leave. Throughout Baghdad, hundreds of armed members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party and security forces were deployed today, taking positions behind sandbags and in foxholes. The White House warned that war against Iraq will be as short as possible, but Americans must be prepared for loss of life. Bush met with his war council, and the White House sent Congress formal notification of justification for war. In two separate documents, Bush said diplomacy has failed to protect America's security, linked Saddam's regime with the al-Qaeda network, and laying out a new rationale for war, said captured Iraqi officials could identify terrorists living in the United States. On Capitol Hill, some lawmakers found it difficult to conduct business as usual under the uncertainties of war. Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut.
I think we ought to be going home and stopping the process right now and go back and be in our states here to be engaging in this debate and discussion. When the attention of our entire country, if not the world, is focused on the brink of war and trying to get the attention of our colleagues and others about a budget like this, it is outrageous that we're doing it now. Without any idea what the cost of this war is going to be or what reconstruction will be, we're sitting here trying to break through and to penetrate on what's going to happen to Head Start, to child care, to Pell Grants, to Title I. And it's very difficult, to put it mildly. This is not coincidental, they're jamming this budget through this day.
U.S. Senator Christopher Dodd at the United Nations in New York today. Members of the Security Council gathered to hear a final report from head weapons inspector Hans Blix.
During the months of the buildup of our resources in Iraq, Larnaca, and New York, and of inspections in Iraq, we have, as was indeed the purpose, learned a great deal that has been useful to know for the drafting of our work program and for the selection of key remaining disarmament tasks. I naturally feel sadness that 3.5 months of work carried out in Iraq have not brought the assurances needed about the absence of weapons of mass destruction or other prescribed items in Iraq, that no more time is available for our inspections, and that armed action now seems imminent.
Secretary General Kofi Annan expressed frustration that the U.S. abandoned attempts for a diplomatic compromise.
Needless to say, I fully share the regrets expressed by many members of this council at the fact that it has not been possible to reach a common position. Whatever our different views on this complex issue, we must all feel that this is a sad day for the United Nations and the international community. I know that millions of people around the world share this sense of disappointment and are deeply alarmed by the prospect of imminent war. It is the plight of the Iraqi people which is now my most immediate concern. And I have been glad to hear that sentiment shared by all the speakers in this debate.
Reaction from member states opposing the advance towards war was swift as ambassadors from France, Germany, and Syria all weighed in.
Within hours, a war of aggression will be unleashed in Iraq, as it was declared in Washington yesterday. Emotions are running high, perhaps as high as the temperature there. By now, anyone with vision and insight have known that this war is unfair and unjustified. It will come back to haunt those who advocate it and promote it instead of enhancing their status in history.
Make no mistake about it. The choice before us is between two visions of the world. To those who choose to use force and think that they can
French
resolve
Foreign Minister
the world's
Dominique
complexity
de Villepin speaking
through
a translator.
Preventive action, we offer, in contrast, resolute action and a long-term approach. For in today's world, to ensure our security, every dimension of a problem must be taken into account. The manifold crisis, and their many dimensions, including the cultural and religion. In international relations, nothing that endures can be built without dialogue and respect for the other, without strictly abiding by principles. To ignore this reality is to run the risk of creating misunderstandings, provoking radicalization and spiraling violence. And this holds true in the Middle East, an area of fractures and ancient conflicts, where stability must be a major objective for us. Over and above what divides us, we share a collective responsibility to confront these threats, a responsibility to restore the unity of the international community.
There is no basis in the UN Charter for regime change with military means. Germany is convinced that the United Nations and the Security Council must continue to play the central role in the Iraq conflict. The Security Council bears the primary responsibility for world peace and international security. The negotiations on the Iraq crisis, which were followed by millions of people worldwide, have shown how relevant and how indispensable the peacemaking role of the Security Council is. There is no alternative to this. No one can seriously believe that disarmament wars are the way forward.
Reaction today at the UN from nation states opposing the invasion into Iraq. Iraqi Foreign Minister Mohammed al-Douri today at the UN Security Council special session.
The executioner cannot help the victim except by killing it and destroying it totally. This is what the United States wants for the Iraqi people. This is what the United States is working for against the Iraqi people. The Council, in order to minimize the magnitude of the humanitarian catastrophe, the expected humanitarian catastrophe, has no choice. The dozens of millions of dollars offered so generously by the United States and the UK is not enough. What is necessary is to renew expeditiously the work of the Oil for Food program, especially that there are humanitarian goods agreed upon amounting to more than $10 billion are on their way to Iraq. The delay of the delivery of the food, medicine, and essential civilian needs will have severe, dire negative effects.
Iraqi Foreign Minister Mohammed al-Douri. Thousands of refugees are expected to flee Iraq in the event of war, and humanitarian organizations operating in Iraq's western neighbor, Jordan, are on high alert. With no way for them to foresee the consequences of a possible all-out military attack on Baghdad, these organizations are basing their preparations on mere estimations. Regardless, they point out that no matter how prepared they are or how much help they can provide, the humanitarian suffering will be tremendous. Ula Ferwati has more from Amman.
Jordan was in a similar situation after the 1991 U.S.-led Gulf War, when hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and third country nationals fled to seek refuge. But relief organizations are afraid that their experience and massive preparations may not be enough to prevent a humanitarian crisis. Mohammed Al-Hadid, the president of Jordan's Red Crescent Society, paints a very dark picture.
The challenges that we have now is usually a disaster takes place and then you send the plea and people start to respond to your plea. Yes. But now we don't have anything, so we don't have any donation, so it is a bit more difficult. I guess at the rate that the international community is really dealing with type of disaster, it will be late to really offer assistance at the appropriate time. So this is the major challenge and the major difficulty that we have, because a lot of people feel that something will happen, yet they cannot donate, because if you give money, if you contribute to this, as if you are saying, yes, war would take place.
The society has started stockpiling supplies, but as of yesterday, no tents were set up in the no man land between Iraq and Jordan, where the local arm of the International Committee of the Red Cross is expected to operate. Dr. Hadid.
We have in stock now enough shelter and non-food items for a number of people, at least 5,000 going to 10,000, with a capacity that we might be able to take care of 25,000. Okay? And then I would like also to say that the Jordan Red Crescent and any Red Cross Red Crescent Society is really unique in its own structure, because we have a counterpart in every part of the world. And what we have is we do also have 4 hospitals available in Europe. Each hospital would be able to serve up to 250,000 people.
The United Nations Higher Commission for Refugees will take care of Iraqis and third country nationals seeking refuge in other countries. It has plans for 2 camps in the Jordan-Iraq border city of Rueshid. The first camp is designed to accommodate a maximum of 35,000 Iraqi nationals, while the other will host third country nationals transiting to their home countries through Jordan. The infrastructure of water, electricity and sewage has been laid down, and camps will be set up in 48 hours in the event of war. As for the Iraqi civilians who choose to stay in Iraq, the International Committee of the Red Cross will provide medical care, shelter and food items. Maureen Qassis is the communication officer at the organization, present in the region since the mid-60s.
That now the International Committee of the Red Cross, within the readiness and the measures it has taken now, it would be ready to meet the humanitarian needs of 150,000 persons inside Iraq within the first month of any military action. We would be able to increase that to meet the needs of around 500,000 civilian population in the first 4 months of the military action. And again, based on the needs assessment that we do constantly on the ground, we would be able to adjust and modify our work to increase it based on the needs of the people.
Dr. Hadid says the Red Crescent will only be able to provide food and water to refugees in the first few hours after the eruption of a conflict. The fact that the camps and the shelters will be set up in the vacuous desert between Jordan and Iraq will further aggravate the situation.
We set up a camp, Sha'lan 1, to accommodate up to 15,000 people back in 1990. But when we saw that it was hot and it was horrible, too hot in the summer, and there were reports of about 165 scorpion bites per night. We have to think about the climate of the desert. It's very hot in summer during the day and extremely cold at night. But now at this time, it's cold both at night and day. So it's going to be really freezing. It's really extremely cold. I had some of my volunteers with me, and these are healthy young people. We're not talking yet about women and children.
The same view was echoed by Qassis, whose organization is currently providing assistance in many war-torn countries in Asia and Africa.
Regardless of the legitimacy of any military action, regardless of who's right and who's wrong, regardless of who is responsible for the current situation of that we are all facing, When I'm talking about that, I have in mind that this situation could happen anywhere in the world, and the suffering would be the same. We're talking, when we mention suffering, we would have in mind the suffering of any civilian population now as a result of a military action. Do we have in mind the people in Angola, the people in the occupied territories, the people in the civilian population in Israel, in Sri Lanka, anywhere, the suffering is the same, and simply the blood of any victim, I think it is red.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ola Farawati in Amman, Jordan.
As the Turkish parliament gets ready to vote tomorrow on whether to allow U.S. troops to launch a northern offensive into Iraq from Turkish soil, Aaron Glantz reports from Diyarbakir in southeastern Turkey that people are making preparations for war.
The streets of downtown Diyarbakir fell silent this afternoon as George Bush's clock ticked down to war on Iraq. Most shops in the normally bustling market were shuttered. Many people stayed inside, watching their country's leadership on television. The Turkish parliament was set to decide tomorrow the number and type of American soldiers allowed to launch a northern front from Turkish soil. The parliament refused to allow the U.S. Army to launch a northern front in March 1st, and the parliament has been under heavy pressure to reverse itself and allow the U.S. troop deployment. But so far, Turkey has resisted. Speaking to reporters today, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan stressed he was only ready to support allowing U.S. warplanes to use Turkish airspace to attack Iraq. But he said his government would continue to refuse the American request for more than 60,000 troops on Turkish soil. Under the plan, American warplanes would not be allowed to use Turkish bases, but would instead have to launch their bombing runs from Europe or American bases. The General Secretary of Harbish, the Turkish War Workers Union, told Pacifica Radio today he believes the United States will use the Incirlik military base in western Turkey to bomb Iraq without getting parliamentary approval. The Bush administration would have the option of airlifting troops directly into Kurdish-controlled northern Iraq. Even without parliamentary approval, the U.S. troops continue to come with convoys of jeeps, Humvees, and military trucks leaving the Mediterranean port of Iskenderun for the border region of Iraq. The U.S. military has leased miles of land near the border, including a large industrial park in Nusaybin. The area has been hit hard by 13 years of economic sanctions on Iraq, and almost everyone here is unemployed. Orhan is helping to build a heliport for the American Army. He's being paid less than $4 a day.
I am against the war, but I have to earn money. We don't want the war. I have 3 brothers and 4 sisters, and I'm the only one who is working. My parents aren't working either. The problem is this. We have to work for money, for food, but we don't want the war.
But not everyone shares his view. Mehmet is a tailor in the nearby town of Kiziltepe.
The people allowing the Americans in aren't just selling their land, they are selling themselves. They are selling their hearts and their minds. If the American soldiers come here, they will never leave.
Meantime, the Kurds of northern Iraq have begun to pack their bags and move out of northern Iraq's main cities toward the Turkish border. Tens of thousands of Turkish troops are already on the ground in northern Iraq, charged with preventing them from reaching Turkish soil. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Diyarbakir, southeastern Turkey.
Today, I weep for my country. Those are the words of U.S. Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia in a speech delivered today on the floor of the U.S. Senate. He said, in part, "We flaunt our superpower status with arrogance. We treat U.N. Security Council members like ingrates who offend our princely dignity by lifting their heads from the carpet. Valuable alliances are split. After war has ended," said Byrd, "the United States will have to rebuild much more than the country of Iraq. We will have to rebuild America's image around the globe. The case this administration tries to make to justify its fixation with war is tainted by charges of falsified documents and circumstantial evidence," he said. "We cannot convince the world of the necessity of this war for one simple reason. This is a war of choice." Many Americans seeking peace as an alternative to war have been shocked and awed at some of the media hype leading up to the invasion. David Brock, author of Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative and former so-called media hitman for the conservative right, joined Peace Watch today for an analysis of the media coverage of the march to war. Brock spent many years as a columnist for the Washington Times and also wrote for Esquire, Rolling Stones magazine, the New York Times, and the Washington Post op-ed pages.
You know, I think that, you know, in the book that I wrote, one of the themes in the book was how conservative media and conservative think tanks and well-funded voices on the right are able to affect the climate of the mainstream press. And I think we've seen a similar phenomenon here that really began after 9/11, where the administration, the Bush administration, was somehow conflated with the idea of being patriotic and being American. And if people did not support the war aims of the administration, either the terror war or the war in Iraq, that a certain climate was set in which those views were not heard, and when they were heard, they were caricatured and marginalized. And so I think there's a real history here going back 18 months. And, you know, people really don't have to, you know, take my word for it. There was a very striking column in the Washington Post this past Sunday by their ombudsman, in other words, their own internal watchdog, who wrote that he saw a troubling pattern at the Washington Post over the last several months where the news was skewed in a pro-war direction. Now, he said that that was not an instance of bias, but it was an example of the media not asking the hard questions, accepting too easily the line coming from the administration. And I think people will remember, certainly people who were involved or watched the anti-war protests last fall, that those were not covered by the media. They did finally get some coverage, but it was almost too late by then. Before the Congress voted, there were instances of Senator Kennedy giving some very powerful anti-war speeches that were hardly covered at all in the Washington Post. There was also congressional testimony by several retired generals who were very concerned about the wisdom of this war that was not covered at all in the main newspaper in our capital before the Congress voted. So this was all set in motion long ago. Now we see, I think, just a kind of fevered frenzy in the press to get on board. If you look at the European press, they've covered the Bush administration much more aggressively than our own press has. We haven't heard in our media, really until the last few weeks, about how the geostrategic plan for this war was drawn up back in the mid-1990s in conservative think tanks. We're just finding out that now.
Pax Americana.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, the whole plan to go beyond Iraq with a list of other possible countries. And apparently, you know, a lot of the concern in Europe is not only with Iraq, but with what comes next. With a few million dollars, people like William Crystal and Richard Perle set out this plan back in 1997, 1998. They had the money to go out and sell it in the press. We still don't really know what the financing of all that was, whether there were oil companies behind mm-hmm. those groups. And so that's sort of a macro issue. Mm-hmm. On a very small level, you know, I turned on CNN a Tuesday morning, and their morning show, Jack Cafferty was reading emails in response to the president's speech Monday night. And he read five emails. Four were for the president. One was against. And that one was signed Anne in Germany. And I have to think there must have been an opposing email that came from inside this country. And so mm-hmm. that's the kind of subtle skewing, I think, that's mm-hmm. going on in the press.
Well, how are the journalists and the reporters at these mainstream media outlets and these newspapers allowed to get away with not asking the tough questions? I think that's really the crux of this problem.
I think that basically Democrats, progressives, liberals, they really don't have any means of holding the press accountable. And I think that's a very serious problem. And that probably has to come from grassroots activism. But, you know, what the conservative movement has done for the last 30 years is spend tens of millions of dollars on watchdog groups that try to intimidate the press and move it in a conservative direction. But there are things that are not done, I think. And I think that complaining, one of them, I think that emails and letters to the editor and efforts to bring some accountability to the press, you know, the airwaves are the public airwaves. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you know, you don't see the kinds of voices of dissent represented.
And there's also major news events that are conspicuously absent from those Sunday morning talk shows. For example, the Sunday TV programs after the speech that was made by Al Baradei, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, before the UN, that a document purporting to show an Iraqi purchase of uranium from Niger had been forged. That document was a key element in a British intelligence report, which the United States in turn had used to build its case against Iraq. But the Sunday morning programs did not pick up on that and basically ignored that revelation. And so it just, you know, it discredits the peacekeepers or those promoting peace in this country and their argument.
That's right. Yeah, one of the things, omission is a very important aspect of press bias. And as you point out with that example, one of the issues is not that the information, such as the story you just cited, is unavailable. It has been reported, is available, but it doesn't really resonate. It doesn't get on the radar screen, and it doesn't get into mainstream discussion precisely because of what you just said, that there's no system of amplification. If you can't trust the mainstream media to do that, I think what is required is a much stronger alternative media. Again, you know, conservatives have built their own conservative media in this country. It's extremely powerful. I mean, you wonder in the opinion polls, for example, the reputation of the United Nations has declined significantly in the last couple of months.
It certainly has.
Now, perhaps that's because of activity that has gone on in the United Nations, but I have to think that some of the conservative spin, some of the conservative efforts to discredit the United Nations, and that demonization of the United Nations doesn't just stay in the conservative audience. In other words, it shapes the national consciousness, and mm-hmm. people hear many, many conservative voices saying the same thing. It is an echo chamber, and if they're not terribly sophisticated news consumers, hearing the same thing said from many, many places gives those views a certain kind of credibility.
And even if you are somewhat sophisticated or consider yourself to be well-informed, once you keep hearing the same thing repeated over and over again from all sorts of different quarters, you start to think, well, wait a minute, is that true or not?
That's right. It's conservative noise, and you know that you can't have all that noise and mm-hmm. contain it just to, you know, the Rush Limbaugh audience. It does affect everything else, and it affects how people think and affects how people see the issue.
David Brock, author of Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. One of the callers to Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington during the community comments segment this morning was poet Jean-Claude T., who's been provoking audiences for years with his unique rhythm of poetry and verse. He expressed frustration with the media coverage of the war in this piece entitled Newsman.
Newsman, you speak of war as though it were a game. You talk of those who'll surely die and some you call by name. Newsman, newsman, I see excitement in your eye. You stop and look and think about the children who will die. Some Americans are sounding just like a lawless mob. They talk of freedom and democracy, not of young lives that they will rob. Newsman, newsman, all singing the same song, saying, follow now our president, be he right or wrong. Newsman, I hear your hollow laughter. When the bombs fall on Baghdad, think of the morning after. Think of the morning after, see the dead up in the tree. Will you hang your head in shame at what has come to be?
Jean-Claude T., a noted Washington area artist and poet. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.